The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. You know, generally, we've talked about some really serious issues, things like aortic aneurysms and congestive heart failure. Today we're going to talk about some things that are maybe a little less serious, but can nevertheless cause us discomfort and disrupt life. So our first article today is about jaw pain. And this is about treatment hinging on many factors. So put a finger on your face just in front of one ear. If you open and close your mouth, you'll feel a bulge as your mouth moves. That's your temporomandibular joint. It's also known as the TMJ. It feels as though it's right beneath the skin, but is actually about an inch below it. The TMJ may not get the attention other joints do. It's similar to a ball and socket joint, just like the hips, and serves a hugely important purpose. When it doesn't function properly, you might have trouble eating, drinking, and talking. Problems in the joint and surrounding muscles can include a clicking sound, pain, headaches, and soreness. It's estimated that about one-third of adults will experience temporomandibular disorders at some point in life, with women at double the rate of men. These disorders are sometimes referred to as TMJ disorders. Most of the time, the discomfort from these disorders is temporary and can be relieved with self-care. But persistent pain may benefit from further evaluation and treatment. The TMJ connects the jawbone, also called the mandible, to the temporal bone on each side of the skull. Muscles and ligaments surrounding the joints control the position and movement of the jaw. A small shock-absorbing disc separates the two bones, helping to keep movement smooth. To allow for the jaw to move both up and down and side to side, the joint functions as a hinge and can slide sideways. TMJ disorders typically stem from issues in one of two places, the joint or the muscles. In some people, both may be involved. Trauma to the jawbones, or TMJ, plays a role in some temporomandibular disorders. The shock-absorbing disc may erode or move out of alignment, or the TMJ itself may be damaged by impact or overworked with time. Degenerative or inflammatory diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis also increase your risk. In fact, it's estimated that over half of people with rheumatoid arthritis also experience a TMJ disorder. Because women are affected more often than men, many experts speculate that a hormonal link may be involved as well. Certain behaviors also may increase the likelihood of developing a TMJ disorder. These include clenching or grinding your teeth and repetitive jaw motions such as from chewing gum, biting fingernails, or smoking a pipe. Poor head and neck posture can contribute to muscle pain. For instance, musicians who use their jaw frequently, including singers, violinists, and woodwind players, also commonly experience jaw pain. Facial pain is the most common symptom of TMJ disorders. Pain may occur in the muscles of the jaw, in the area in front of the ear, or with either or both joints. It's common for pain to occur with chewing. Sometimes you'll hear a clicking sound, too. Other symptoms are headache, earache, difficulty opening and closing the mouth, and tooth pain. Most people develop only a mild form of TMJ disorder. Symptoms usually improve significantly or disappear fully within a few weeks to months, especially with good self-care. However, other people may develop pain that can be long-term and even debilitating. Talk with your healthcare team if you have jaw symptoms that last a week or longer. TMJ disorders are usually diagnosed based on your symptoms, health history, and findings from a physical exam. Imaging tests aren't typically needed, but may be used with long-term symptoms and to check for underlying causes of pain such as arthritis. Self-care and medications also often contain the pain. Some of these treatment options for TMJ include 1. Cold or heat therapy. Applying warm, moist heat or an ice pack to the side of your face may ease pain, depending on your symptoms. Acute pain is best treated with an ice pack. Chronic dull pain is best treated with heat therapy. 2. Changes to daily habits. Avoid teeth clenching and nail biting. Eat soft foods or take smaller bites of food, and avoid other large jaw movements, such as with gum chewing and wide yawning. Practice good resting jaw posture with your tongue gently resting on the roof of your mouth, teeth apart, and jaw in a relaxed position. 3. Oral occlusal appliances. Often people with jaw pain benefit from wearing a device inserted over their teeth at night. These devices not only protect the teeth, but also support the TMJ and surrounding muscles. This may reduce pain and other symptoms. Lastly, there's physical therapy. Along with exercises to stretch and strengthen jaw muscles, treatments might include dry needling therapy and transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, also known as TENS. Also, moist heat and stretching are effective in repeated applications throughout the day. Non-prescription pain medications such as ibuprofen, also known as Advil or Motrin IV and others, may be used to provide temporary relief. Or your care team may recommend other options, such as a stronger pain medication, muscle relaxant, or antidepressant drug to help relieve symptoms. Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, may be recommended to help you understand the factors and actions that may aggravate your pain so you can avoid them. This may be particularly beneficial for people who also experience anxiety or depression along with TMJ disorder. There are some more involved procedures. For severe and lasting jaw pain, the other options may be considered, and these include 1. Arthrocentesis. Arthrocentesis is a minimally invasive procedure that involves inserting small needles into the joint so that fluid can be flushed through it to remove debris and inflammatory byproducts. 2. There are injections. In some people, corticosteroid injections into the joint may help. Rarely, injecting Botox into the jaw muscles used for chewing may ease pain related to TMJ disorders. Thirdly, there's TMJ arthroscopy. A small, thin tube called a cannula is placed into the joint space. Then a lighted viewing instrument called an arthroscope is inserted, and small tools are used for surgery. TMJ arthroscopy generally has fewer risks and complications than open joint surgery does. 4th, there's modified condylotomy. This procedure addresses the TMJ indirectly with surgery on the mandible, but not on the joint itself. It increases joint space to allow the rounded end of the mandible, called the condyle, to move more freely. The procedure may ease pain and locking. Lastly, there's open joint surgery. If your jaw pain does not go away with more conservative treatments and a structural issue in the joint appears to be causing the pain, open joint surgery may be worth considering to repair or replace the joint. but open joint surgery involves more risk than the other procedures. Our next article is about hair loss. Up to 100,000 hair follicles can be found on your head. In youth, the buds that emerge out of the follicles pop through the scalp without hesitation, like flowers shooting out of the soil in spring. Hairs cover the head, looking vibrant and regrowing at a healthy rate. Later in life, it's more common for growth to slow or even stop. The buds form, but they may not be able to breach the scalp line. Gradual thinning is a typical part of aging. But people with androgenetic alopecia, the most common type of hair loss, experience additional changes. The length of the growth phase shortens over time, and hair doesn't grow as thick or as sturdy, a process called miniaturization. Eventually, the growth phase becomes so short that the hair produced fails to reach the surface of the scalp. Hereditary hair loss with age is the most common cause of baldness, but effective treatments are available to prevent hair loss and restore growth. For men, hair loss can begin as early as the teens, although it usually becomes more prominent at and after midlife. Male pattern hair loss is characterized by a receding hairline at the temples and balding at the top of the head. About half of men experience some degree of androgenetic alopecia by age 50. It tends to run in families, including a genetic predisposition, with multiple genes likely involved. Androgens, which are hormones that figure prominently in male development, drive the process of hair follicle miniaturization. Patterns of hair loss are a bit different in women. Hair loss often occurs after menopause, although sometimes the process begins earlier. Rather than getting a receding hairline, women usually lose density, generally around the top of the head, temples, or middle part line. Though the scalp may be visible in these places, complete hair loss is unusual in women. The causes of hair loss in women aren't as clear. Hormones are likely involved, including androgens, but not all women with hair loss have high androgen levels. Multiple genes and hereditary components likely play a role in female pattern hair loss. Androgenetic alopecia is recognized less often in women, but the psychological impact of thinning hair can be considerable. Before making a diagnosis, your healthcare team will likely examine you and ask about your diet, hair care routine, and medical and family history. You also might have blood tests, a scalp biopsy, or a pull test in which a medical professional gently pulls out several dozen hairs to test follicle strength. Treatments are available to help minimize hair loss and promote growth. Those options include, one is minoxidil, known as Rogaine, and others. This non-prescription medication is for men and women. It comes as a liquid or foam that you rub on your scalp regularly. You may experience some hair regrowth, a slower rate of hair loss, or both. Early on, some existing hair may fall out as the follicles are stimulated to produce new growth. Experts recommend that you use the treatment for about 9 months before assessing the results. Once you stop treatment, you lose any regrowth. The second is finasteride, also known as Propecia. This is a prescription medication available as a pill or a cream. The pill form is approved to treat male pattern hair loss. Full effects of the treatment may take up to a year and require continued use. Finasteride stops the conversion of testosterone into dihydrotestosterone, a hormone that can shrink hair follicles. Third, there's hair transplant surgery. Transplants may offer permanent improvement for some people, particularly those who have plenty of hair elsewhere on their heads that can be transplanted. During a transplant session, a medical professional takes tiny patches of skin, each containing one to several hairs, from the back or side of the scalp. Sometimes a larger strip of skin containing multiple hair groupings is taken. The patches or strip is then implanted into the affected areas follicle by follicle. The new hair stays there for the duration of the growth and rest cycles, but hereditary hair loss progresses with time, so some hair loss occurs eventually. Another option is laser therapy. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved a low-level laser device as a treatment for hereditary hair loss in men and women. A few small studies have shown that it improves hair density. Yet another option is platelet-rich plasma injections. This treatment uses the body's restorative capability to help improve and maintain hair growth. Platelets are isolated from a person's own blood. The resulting concentrated platelets are then injected into the scalp. And lastly, there are hair products that can help. Your hairstylist may be able to recommend volumizing hair products or styling techniques that make your hair look fuller. There are also tinted creams and powders that can help minimize the color difference between your hair and scalp. Other options are wigs and hair pieces, which can effectively cover hair loss. A dermatologist or hair stylist can help you find high-quality resources. Next, we're going to turn to chronic itching. Everyone gets an occasional itch, but sometimes itching can last for days or weeks. Severe or persistent itching can become annoying, distracting, and even torturous. And it can lead to other serious health concerns, including insomnia, anxiety, and depression, all of which interfere with your health and quality of life. It's fine to scratch an itch every now and then, but ongoing scratching can intensify the itch, a process known as the itch-scratch cycle. Constant scratching over the same area for a prolonged time may also cause the skin to become thick and leathery, a condition known as lichen complex chronicus or neurodermatitis. This can make the itch more challenging to treat. Let's look at rash-related causes first. Chronic itching could be triggered by health conditions or by your environment. If you have an itch that persists for a few weeks or longer, see your healthcare team to determine the cause and decide on a treatment. For a diagnosis, a member of your care team checks the appearance of your skin. A rash may include redness or other skin color changes, bumps, scaling, blisters, or hives. Possible causes of itching with a rash include dry skin. The most common cause of itching in older adults is dry skin. Dry skin often has an ashy appearance. Small white flakes or scales are also sometimes visible. The condition can be worsened by frequent bathing, especially with hot water and excessive soap, and dry air, especially in the winter. Another cause can be skin diseases. Itching may be caused by psoriasis, various forms of dermatitis or skin inflammation, hives, skin infections, or even skin cancer. There may be infection-related conditions. Fungal infections may occur, often in moist or warm areas, such as in body folds or on the feet. Shingles, chickenpox, scabies, or lice can also cause itching. And lastly, there are allergic reactions and irritation. Skin may become inflamed and irritated after contact with things such as poison ivy, cosmetics, metals, wool, perfumes, and cleaning products. This condition is known as contact dermatitis. What about when there's not a rash? It's possible for itch to occur without a rash. It can affect many or all areas of the body at once. This form of chronic itching is more likely to be caused by 1. Underlying disease. This can include liver or kidney disease, iron deficiency anemia, thyroid conditions, cancers such as leukemias or lymphomas, and autoimmune diseases such as scleroderma. 2, side effects of drugs. Certain medications, such as opioids for pain, may trigger chronic itching. 3, nerve issues. A pinched, damaged or irritated nerve may cause itching in a widespread or focused area. It can develop after a shingles episode or a stroke or with nerve damage due to diabetes. Regardless of underlying causes, dry skin often is a factor in chronic itching. Gentle skin care and moisturizers often are beneficial. Your care team may recommend additional steps for faster relief. For example, a non-prescription corticosteroid cream, such as hydrocortisone, may calm inflamed skin. A cold pack or lotions containing menthol, camphor, or calamine may provide cooling relief. Other effective anti-itch ingredients may include pramoxine and capsaicin. With capsaicin, it's best to try a small amount at first, since it may initially cause a burning or stinging sensation. Other potential treatments include 1. Prescription creams or ointments. Higher potency options may be recommended to manage itch and other symptoms caused by conditions such as dermatitis. Products include corticosteroid creams and ointments and calcineurin inhibitors. 2. Wet dressings. This measure can enhance the effectiveness of topical corticosteroids. The process involves applying the corticosteroid to the affected areas and then covering the areas with damp dressings to help your skin absorb the medicine while also cooling and hydrating the skin. Thirdly, there are antihistamines. An allergy medicine can help with itching. This type of pill may be especially beneficial before bedtime if your itchy skin disrupts your sleep. However, beware of drowsiness that can happen with some antihistamines. Another option is drugs to act on the nervous system. Topical drugs that act on nerves may be recommended when the itching appears to be caused by a nerve dysfunction. Oral drugs that act on the nervous system, such as antidepressants and anti-seizure drugs, may also be effective. Another possible treatment is phototherapy. This therapy involves repeatedly exposing your skin to specific wavelengths of ultraviolet light. These treatments are useful for conditions such as psoriasis and eczema, known as atopic dermatitis. They also may be effective for some types of itching where there is no visible rash. And lastly, there's an important approach through emotional support. Techniques such as relaxation and habit reversal training may be used to cope with chronic itching. Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, also can help break the itch-scratch cycle. Remember that your itch, as unpleasant as it may be, is rarely untreatable. Working closely with your care team, you typically can find solutions that end the itch and let you get back to living well. Next, did you know that body mass index may have a competitor? For decades, body mass index, or BMI, has been a clinical standard to estimate body fat and screen for being overweight. Carrying excess weight, especially around the belly, is known as a risk factor for health concerns such as diabetes, heart disease, sleep apnea, and some types of cancer. In fact, obesity is a top 5 risk factor for early death. BMI is quick and easy to calculate with your height and weight. Although BMI estimates total body fat better than weight alone, it has flaws. It's a one-size-fits-all guide that doesn't take into account your sex, age, race, ethnicity, frame size, or muscle mass. That's why Olympic athlete fit and at the top of their games can be categorized as overweight or even obese on the BMI scale due to their muscular builds. BMI doesn't measure body fat percentage or distribution. Thus, it can't differentiate between the fat around the buttocks or thighs and the more dangerous fat around the belly. The fat you can pinch is located under your skin and is less concerning. The fat you can't pinch, known as visceral fat, is located deep inside your abdomen and surrounds your organs. Visceral fat raises your risk of many serious health conditions and early death from any cause. There's growing research that suggests that there's maybe a better way to measure body fat distribution. That's known as the Body Roundness Index, or BRI. BRI uses height and waist circumference, or sometimes hip circumference, to measure fat distribution. Studies suggest that BRI may be a better barometer for predicting risk of health conditions such as cardiovascular disease, kidney disease, cancer, depression, anxiety, sleep disorders, metabolic syndrome, and diabetes. While BRI appears to be a contender as a public health screening tool, Mayo Clinic experts don't foresee a seismic shift away from BMI anytime soon. More research is needed to validate recent findings, especially to account for differences in age, sex, race, and ethnicity. BRI also may be more difficult to use because it requires correct waist or hip measurements. Lastly, let's take a look at the relationship between serious falls and the risk of dementia. Falls are the leading cause of injury among older adults. Could they also be an early indicator of cognitive decline? A new study found that a diagnosis of dementia in older adults was more likely within 1 year after they had a serious fall. The study looked at data from almost 2.5 million adults aged 66 and older who did not have an existing dementia diagnosis but had a traumatic injury that caused them to go to the emergency room to be hospitalized. About half of them, or around 1.2 million, were injured by a fall. Those who had fallen were 21% more likely to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or a related dementia in the next year compared with those whose injuries were due to something else. Just over 10%, about 130,000, were diagnosed with some form of dementia within the next year. The researchers who conducted the study, which was published in JAMA Network Open, noted that the results could not directly link falls and dementia. They emphasized that some of the people may have had undiagnosed dementia at the time of their falls or had mild cognitive impairment that progressed to dementia afterwards. But the researchers say their findings suggest that having older adults undergo cognitive screening after a serious fall may help detect dementia sooner. That's all. We've run out of time for today's episode. Please be sure to listen next time. Hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and hearing impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast on our website.